Well, last week we talked about a lesson that really looked at the church as a vehicle for bringing us to a certain destination. And the church is to serve people, not the other way around. We are not here to serve the church being the congregation, but rather the congregation system, if you will, exists here to serve the people. One vehicle then supplies a number of people's needs. The purpose of the congregation is not just to have a congregation. In other words, we're not just here just because we're here and because we had nothing else to do this morning and, you know, every Sunday morning or whenever it is that we meet. The congregation exists to fulfill a higher purpose than itself. And knowing that purpose, and this is really what this whole series is about, knowing that purpose maximizes our effectiveness and our efficiency. So that we can be, like Philippians 2:2 says, intent on one purpose, having the same mind, the same love, and the same spirit. And the failure to recognize or discover that purpose leaves us, well, hamstrung, if you will, and without direction. It also leaves us vulnerable to abuse and misuse and stagnation. And I know what some of us might be saying, or maybe we said it in the past, well, we have the Bible and that is sufficient. And I would agree, of course, with that as far as doctrine and information is concerned. We don't need anything but the Bible in order to tell us how to live rightly with God. The Bible provides all the information that is necessary for entering into fellowship with God and living in that fellowship from that point forward. But what do we do with all that information? What do we do with all that doctrine? Why do we assemble together and identify as a church if all we need is a Bible? We should just hand out Bibles to everyone out in the parking lot and go home and read those, and that would be sufficient. If the Bible is all that's necessary, then we would just hand those out and say, "Be ye warmed and filled," and we'd be done with it, right? There must be something more than that. And having possession of a Bible or knowing the facts and the verses in the Bible doesn't automatically lead to spiritual maturity. I know that because I know there have been people in the church that have been there for decades. I don't mean just in this congregation, but any congregation. And they still have not really matured to the level that they should have. They've had a Bible all along. Virtually every so-called Christian religion uses the Bible in one way or another, and yet they remain steeped in error. So just having a Bible by itself and having access to that word by itself isn't the answer. There's more needed than just having a Bible. We also need to use that Bible properly. 2 Timothy chapter 2:15 says that we're to be accurately handling the word of truth. And that implies that the truth can be handled inaccurately or it can be handled not at all. In other words, it can be neglected. And that's not what we want to do. You might recall Hosea 4 verse 6, a popular verse in this context here where God says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge." Having access to knowledge and being knowledgeable aren't the same things by themselves. So we want to be a knowledgeable people, but we also want to apply that knowledge in the right way. It is unwise and illogical to hope that growth is going to occur just because we sit here, or because we have Bibles, or because we have all the expected features of a so-called growing church. Well, we have elders, we have preachers, we have sermons, we have pews, you know, we've got PowerPoint and the Lord's Supper, and you know, we've got all the features of a growing church, so therefore we must be growing. Not necessarily true. If there is no goals, if there is no stated purpose, if there is no strategy, then we cannot hope to be successful. And without the grace of God directly involved, we will not be successful. I guarantee that. We will be successful as a church, but we will not be successful as a church that is truly of Christ. So we don't want to just be a church, a man-made religious organization that anybody can be a part of for any reason at all. We want to be a church that Christ says, "This is the kind of people I want you to be," and therefore is willing to put his name on us, not just us hijack his name for our own end. So you have to recognize with all that Christians have needs. We have spiritual needs. We have human needs. And the local church is capable of meeting some of those needs, but not all of them. And I'll explain that as we go through the lesson. Now, I'm not talking about wants here, and that's where everyone goes, you know. Well, I need a church that, you know, fulfills me in a certain way. Actually, you may not. You need a church that does for you what your soul requires. We're not here to address creature comforts and pet projects. We are not a social welfare agency. We do not offer group therapy. We are not here to sponsor institutions or institutional isms or any other isms. Isms are man-made, not God-wrought. So we are here to use this vehicle that God has given to us to support a purpose for which he intended, and that will address the spiritual needs of the people over time. So backing up just a little bit, in any group, secular or religious, you know that people have to be associated with accomplishing an overall purpose. People need to know where this thing is going. That's how they buy into it, right? Any good salesman always starts with, first of all, the need and then fulfillment, okay? And that's a good thing to do because, well, it's necessary. We need to know what is the function of this group that we call a church so that people will want to contribute to it. And that's what we want. We want people to contribute to this. I don't mean just in money, of course, but more importantly, in their efforts, in their time, in their energy, in their talents. People are not going to invest in something they don't believe in. Why would you invest in something you don't believe in? It just doesn't make any sense. And the greater the association, the greater the connection, the more intense the desire. And with that desire comes greater participation. You think about Jesus with his disciples turned apostles. I mean, he was there and he created a desire within them so that when he left them and ascended to heaven, they carried out that desire in the form of actual implementation of what he taught them. So he created with them in that desire to follow him and what that meant and what that translated to and what that actually looked like. He created that within them, and then they bought into that so much so that they were willing to, and actually did, lay down their lives for him. And I know what we think. We think, well, we teach biblical truth, and that's our greatest selling point. And that is an excellent selling point, and I don't want to shy away from that at all. But it's not the one that everyone gravitates to at first. And I know that might sound shocking, but it comes down to this. This is the first thing that people are looking for, is that we believe in the biblical truth that we teach. People want to know that we're serious about this. People want to know that we're authentic. People want to know that we're real. People want to know that we have bought into this. And that we're not just doing this haphazardly or casually or when it's convenient and fits our schedule. People want to know that we actually believe in this so much that we are willing to lay down our time and lay down our schedules and lay down our efforts and lay down our talents for the purpose of what this thing is here. Because if we're not willing to do that, then we're not really authentic. People need to see our passion. They need to see our zeal, but they also need to see our knowledge, and they also need to see our accuracy to what the Bible teaches. That's going to make a big impression on people. You might look at it this way. It's not like people are going to say, well, this truth is what I need to help me. Rather, people are going to come to us and say, these people are going to help me understand this truth and how to implement it. And you might think, well, then they're using us for the wrong reason. But it's actually not, because you probably did this yourself. You didn't gravitate toward the truth as much as you did. You gravitated toward the people who believed in this truth because you believed in this truth and you had to see it real in them. Now, I'd like to say that your faith wouldn't be dependent upon people by themselves. But at the same time, people are a part of that process. People need the gospel. But what draws people to the gospel is our unwavering personal conviction in the gospel, that it is real, that it works. What would be the point of this? Me going to someone and saying, hey, you have sins, my friend, and this gospel will help you take away those sins and lead you into a life of fellowship with God and a walk that is the best walk on the face of this earth and a life that is the best life and a servitude that can, you know, is second to none and so on. And I hope that this works for you. It doesn't work for me, but I hope that it does for you. I mean, I don't believe in all this, but I hope you do. What would be the point of that, right? I mean, and I wonder sometimes if churches aren't doing just that very thing. Like, we've got the truth. You need to obey the truth. We don't always obey it ourselves, but you need to. We believe in Jesus Christ. Well, you know, we do kind of. But you have to believe in him even more so. This is not only true for unbelievers, it's true for believers. We ourselves, amongst ourselves, need to see other people in our group who see the truth, who know the truth, who are convinced of the truth, and are serious about the truth. Again, I want to stress, your faith should not be dependent upon other people's faith or other people's disposition, but at the same time, you are looking for that. And the church provides that vehicle, provides that group. I know what doesn't work. Guilt, threats, intimidation, coercion, these are not successful. These may get people to participate, but with little desire. We may end up with people coming and working together, but it will be for all the wrong reasons. And so this is why legalism never works, is because it produces the wrong intention, the wrong motive. That's why Jesus never used it. Have you ever noticed that? Jesus never twisted anyone's arm. He made the offer, people walked away, or they gravitated to him, and he let them do whatever they chose. When Christians get beyond the I have to be involved stage to the I need to be involved stage, then everything changes for them. And that's where we want people to be. We want to get out of the, oh, I have to show up for services, I have to read my Bible, I have to, love my fellow brother in Christ and so on, to the, I need to do this, not only for that person, but for myself and especially for my God. We talked this morning in class about to the praise of his glory, and how we should honor God and honor him not just with our mouths, but honor him with our lives, honor him with our deeds. That motive provides a driving force for people. But you've got to understand, too, that this responsibility is two-sided. Not only are there those who have to provide those living examples of what it means to be authentic and real, we also need those people who are watching them to be authentic and real in following those good examples. So I'm going to put this another way here. You have an ability to give toward people's needs that they have and that you can fulfill. But those other people are also expected to receive what is given. And knowing both sides of this does help to clarify and to crystallize and to sharpen the focus of our overall purpose of why we are a church. It addresses both sides here. So first of all, I want to focus on giving what we have to offer. Each member participates in a personal ministry for, what 1 Corinthians 12:7 says, the common good. In other words, the whole group. We're not here for any one person or any particular family or any particular age group or demographic. We're here for the whole group. So what happens there? Well, there's your physical participation. This is one thing you can give. Be here. And this is what I've been saying over the summer here in our various lessons. Be here. Why? Because your presence means a great deal. Not just here, right here at this moment, but at other times, anytime this church comes together. The empty pew says a lot. I'm not talking about a pew that is empty because we don't have enough members in our congregation. I'm talking about pews that are empty because members chose not to be here. That speaks a lot, and it doesn't help our purpose. Help fellow Christians. Everyone has skills and crafts and talents and money and friendship to offer. The church does not remove this help nor replace it, but it does provide a context in which it can be done. Let's face it, there's a lot of us who in this church have helped one another because we're part of this church. It was this vehicle that God gave us the opportunities and the attention to and the acknowledgement of needs in other people's lives that we know. So the church provides for that, and that's a good thing. Provide personal encouragement. I like Hebrews 13, verse 3, where the writer says, encourage one another day after day, as long as it is called today, lest any one of you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. So what is that telling me? Well, we need each other. We need each other not only for warning, but we also need each other for encouragement, building up, exhortation, stimulation, stimulating one another to love and good deeds. We have a higher objective than ourselves, and we want to give to that objective. Also, biblical and spiritual knowledge and insight. We have that to offer. Many of us do. It's not just preachers. Just because you're teaching a class doesn't mean you're more enlightened than everyone else, or that you're preaching a lesson mean that you're smarter than everyone else. It just means that that's what you're doing. There's a lot of people who have a lot to offer. And I know that there's classes and studies going on. Sometimes I don't even know about them. And honestly, I like that because that tells me there's a lot more going on than what I'm responsible for. And that's a good thing. 2 Timothy 2, verse 2, Paul says that we are to teach people to teach people. Entrust these things to faithful men and women who will be able to teach others also. So what are we supposed to do? Well, teach others so that they can teach others. We need a perpetuating program of teaching then. And that's all part of our purpose. We need counseling and guiding and advising, all different kinds and levels. There's mentoring where we take someone under our wing and show them. And that mentoring refers to someone who's been there, who's walked that walk already, knows the way, knows what you're going to encounter. And we need also leadership. We need someone to guide us in the right way. And we need to know that this is the right way and that you're going it yourself, going in that direction. We need problem solvers because we run into problems. And some of us are better than others at solving those problems. I don't have all the answers. I don't think I'm supposed to have all the answers. But I know that God has those answers. And I know that collectively what we can do is we can solve any problems that come up that stand in the way of our fellowship with God. And we need teaching, classes and sermons, home studies, one-on-one studies. We need to defend the truth, but we also need to expound that truth. Not just say, well, this is what this says, you know, and then we're done. We need to have that explained. And the reason I can say that so safely is because that's what Jesus did. He gave teachings, and then the disciples said, tell us more. And he expounded on that for their sakes, and we need that. That happened in Acts many times too. We need evangelism, spreading the gospel to those without a relationship with Christ out of love for those people's souls. There's a lot of things that you can do to give. And there are a lot of needs that need to be given toward. But there's also the receiving side of this and allowing the congregation to provide for what serves your best interest. So because you have needs too. You have spiritual needs, which can be in part fulfilled by that biblical education and knowledge, the understanding of Christian beliefs, helping people, helping you to understand your relationship with Christ. I mean, just think about our class this morning in Ephesians. What were we talking about? We were talking about that. We were talking about understanding your relationship with Jesus Christ in Christ. What that context means and what's required of you and what you benefit from all that. So we need that. But that requires, if you're a receiver, that requires your time, your effort, your responsibility there. It's not just I'm just going to sit back and, you know, fold my arms and let you give to me and feed me and I'll soak it up, as I feel I need to. No, you have a responsibility to be receiving that. The church offers emotional support to some extent. People in our group go through difficult times and grief and despair and even anger. There's also positive times of joy and appreciation and encouragement. And we're supposed to be there for both sides, right? Romans chapter 12, verse 15, we rejoice with those who rejoice. We also weep with those who weep. And we've had a lot of rejoicing here. We've had a lot of weeping here. And we're here to support people in both sides and everything in between. We have mental needs that need to be fulfilled that you can receive. Intellectual support, I'd like to say critical thinking, wise use of scriptures, sound reasoning, positive thinking. You know, I can provide some of that in through the preaching method and, you know, what I teach, but you can provide that too. And there is a lot of people who can receive that and should receive that. It's meant to be received. But there is some work on your part. You can't just sit there, you know, soaking it up, in whatever way you choose. You need to make some effort toward that too. People need physical help, aiding and assisting with physical needs, collective benevolence, whatever else is needed. I want to clarify on this point, the congregation is not the primary source for your physical needs. In other words, don't come to us first if you have others that can help you out, specifically your family, and then, of course, your friends, and then come to us if they can't help you out. But we may be able to offer those helps, and we have certainly done that in the past. And then there are social needs, and I want to be careful on this because everyone gets off, gets their bristles up there when I start talking about this. I'm not saying the congregation is responsible to sponsor or organize social activities, but you can't escape the fact, the point I made last week, that individuals from this congregation do social things together because we're from this congregation. We have a distinctive relationship. We had a class Thursday night at the Mian's house on happiness and joy, and who was invited? Well, this congregation. Why? Because, well, we are a congregation. And so we have a social connection, and believe me, we had a lot of socializing there after our study there, and eating food and drinking coffee and talking about, religious things, but also everything else. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It's a healthy thing. It binds and unites us in those collective activities. So what am I saying here? Well, we should be a giving and receiving group. The congregation is a vehicle which can help to address these things. It's too much for any one person or even a few people. And it's impossible, I want to stress, it is impossible for the local church to meet all your needs completely and continually. That's not its function. That's not our intent. At the same time, we can provide what is needed to some extent, and you will be a giver in some cases, and you will be a receiver in others. Let's face it, we are a diverse group with different needs. We have single people, we have widows and widowers, we have single parents, we have young families, we have middle-aged families, we have older couples, we have a variety of ethnicities. We have a variety of social classes and income levels, educational backgrounds, even religious backgrounds. And I hate to say it, but we have people who listen to Willie Nelson and we have those who don't. And I'm not trying to say which side you're on right now, but, we have people that drink real coffee. And anyway, you know what it's talking about. So we do have, different aspects, different variations. We have a diversity here. And remember last week's lesson, I talked about unity and diversity. In the world, that really doesn't work because it's a very selfish thing. Because everyone wants to stay where they are and not move and wants the world to cater to their diversity. But in the church, we use our diversity to bring us together and to do a common work. It kind of turns the whole thing on its head, and that is a good thing. Such needs can be addressed for all those different groups I mentioned there without sacrificing the overall objective, as long as we know what that objective is. The problem is that churches get so caught up in what they are doing in their busyness that they forget why they are doing it in the first place. I said something really important just then. I hope you picked up on it. Churches get busy doing things but lose sight of why they should have done them or did do them in the first place. The group needs first to recognize the needs of the people in order to grow, and then we can utilize this vehicle that God has provided, called this congregation, to address those needs. James 1:17 says that all good things, every perfect gift, has come down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no shifting shadow. We must recognize that the congregational structure and the blueprint for that congregation has come to us as a gift from God. This congregation is a gift to us. And if you are here as a member, you should see yourself as being blessed by this gift. And if you want to become a member, you should see that we have a great gift to offer to you, not something we came up with, but something we do participate in. And we would love for you to join us in that. So I've been talking about needs, and other people might be thinking about wants. And by confusing the two or blurring the lines between the two, that does lead to some unrealistic expectations. So I do need to take a moment to clarify. We do not need to be entertained when we come together. I understand that we like to be entertained. I also understand that in the secular world, we are used to being entertained, and many churchgoers expect to be entertained, but it is not necessary, and it is not the reason for our existence, to entertain you. We do not need to walk away from every service and get-together just flushed with emotional excitement and euphoria and rejuvenation. Sometimes, and I can speak from experience, you will walk away from these gatherings depleted and exhausted. So it's not about us trying to jack everybody up and make sure they all have a smile plastered on their face and take away all their troubles and give them a good shot of religion and spirituality in the arm as they go out the door. We do not go to services to find joy and happiness. Joy and happiness come as a result of a deep love and gratitude for our Savior, and a deep gratitude for His forgiveness, and your participation in obeying that Savior, and you participating specifically in serving others. If you're doing those things, then you will have joy. But not because you're here, necessarily, okay? I'm not here to make you joyful. I don't think I could do that even if I wanted to, all right? That's not my job. We do not need perfect people, and we don't need flawless performances in order to function and meet the purpose for which this group came together at all. As God has showered us with grace and has tolerated our human imperfections and continues to do so, so we should shower other people with grace. Not saving grace, obviously, but still graciousness, and we should be tolerant of their imperfections. We do not need man-made creeds. We do not need man-made programs to be successful. In fact, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, talks about that God has blessed us with everything that we need through the Word and through our relationship with Christ. We do not need celebrity speakers. We do not need motivational speakers in order to hear the truth of God. We do not need cutting-edge technology in order to lead people to Christ and to be baptized into Christ. Now, if those things can help us, so be it. But we do not need them, because our reason for teaching people is not dependent upon having state-of-the-art sound systems, visual systems, and, you know, other systems. It's dependent upon understanding what the Word is and what it says to do. We do not need always to be givers because of guilt. Like, well, I have much, and therefore, out of guilt, I feel like I have to constantly give. And we do not always need to be receivers because of convenience, because of our choice. Like, you know what? I kind of like sitting back and letting everyone give to me. I don't have to give. I just have to always be a receiver. No, you need to be a giver, and you need to be a receiver. And it's not for me to decide when that's going to happen, and it's not for you to decide that either. It is God that decides that, and all you're doing is cooperating with what He says. We need both, and you need to be both at different times. All right, so let's look at this in maybe another way here. Typically, members mature through three stages. First of all, they focus on themselves and their families. Self, I just called it. But it's themselves and their families. Their second stage of growth, they start focusing on the group that they belong to, the congregation. The third stage of growth in their advance in maturity is they start focusing on others. This is pretty normal and typical and expected. I'm not saying that you can't get involved in other, you know, aspects there, you know, that self lasts for so many years and then the group and so on. In fact, what I find is a lot of new Christians are involved with not only themselves, but actually start focusing on the lost before many other people do. But what I'm saying is, where our primary attention seems to be, our predominant emphasis over time, we do focus, first of all, on, you know, the small circle. And then the circle gets bigger. And then the circle gets, you know, as big as possible. Every member who is here right now is at one of these three levels in essence. And every member ideally is actively seeking the next one. Ideally, I said. This is what you should be doing, in other words. And when you get to the third level, it doesn't mean you're done. It means sometimes what we do is we go back and we reevaluate those first couple levels and we see, how can I do this better? And then we perfect that. We as we move forward, we also improve as we go along. So our purpose, whatever our purpose is, needs to address all three levels and provide a means to ascend from one to another. And that requires knowledge of purpose, but it also involves implementation of that knowledge and that purpose to accommodate that. And it also requires leadership of those men and women in their different capacities who have already gone through this format or through this growing stage here. It's common to the entire process, I should say, is communication. We need to have communication. People have to be informed. They have to be taught. The New Testament example is clear that we are to teach them to observe all that Christ has taught us, rather than sitting back and assuming that, you know, over time we're just going to morph into spiritual giants. That's just not going to happen by itself. So this is why we have preachers. This is why we have teachers, and this is why we need elders and leaders, and this is why we have people not only to lead us by example, but also to inspire us actively, like, come follow me. In other words, not only am I knowing the right way to go and going that way myself, but I'm also encouraging, beckoning, and actively, sometimes even, you know, pulling if I need to, those people to follow me. If indeed I am in that leadership position, I just explained the three aspects of leadership. You know the right way to go, you go that way yourself, and you inspire others to follow you. So we ought to have nothing to hide as a group. Everyone ought to know our goals and our intentions. I don't care who knows them. It's not something we publicize necessarily, but it's not something that we're hiding from anyone either. We need to remind each other to be responsible to that goal and also to be accountable. That's not a bad thing. It's a healthy thing. Unfortunately, it's often missing as well. I want you to consider another approach that's similar to this, but we're just using different words, speaking a different language, but reaching the same conclusion. Again, I'm speaking in generalities. We start out by knowing, first of all. Oops, I don't want to go forward yet. We start by knowing information. We get acquainted. We draw closer to Christ. We draw closer to Christians. Turn with me to Hebrews chapter 5, please. Hebrews chapter 5, starting in verse 13 and 14. Now, the writer in verse 11 has really reprimanded the people he's writing to and says, you've become dull of hearing. But look at what he says positively we should be looking at. Verse 13 says, for everyone who partakes only of milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness, for he is an infant in his spiritual state, that is. But solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. Well, what is he saying? Well, as I understand it, basically, in principle, he's saying we start out as infants, and then we mature to something better than that or beyond that, right? And so we start out on basic elementary principles, but we're not to camp there forever. We're supposed to use that knowledge and move forward. This is reasonable and realistic, and I'm not trying to stop anyone who is at first level primary stages and saying, oh, you're wrong, you should be somewhere else. What I'm saying is we all start there. It's not a bad thing, it's not a wrong thing, but you don't want to make it a career either, right? Then we start walking, and we surpass the early stages of learning and development. We start living what we've learned. We start internalizing and turning that knowledge into a habitual practice. Just like Hebrews chapter 6, verse 1 says, if you're still there, leaving behind the elementary teaching about the Christ, let us press on to maturity. That's what you're doing. You're pressing on to maturity. You're leaving behind those basic, fundamental ABC things, and you're walking forward. All right, then 1 John 2, 6 says, the one who says he abides in him, in Christ, ought himself to walk in the same manner as he walked. So that has to happen. You have to put into practice what you learn. You're not faithful if you're not doing that. You're not faithful if you're not pursuing that. In fact, I will go so far as to say that no one is faithful who refuses to conform to the master. There is no exception to that. Doesn't matter who you are, how long you've been a Christian, you know, how many people you know in the church or anything else. You're not faithful if you don't conform to the master. So the maturing of the internal life begins manifesting itself in the external fruit. Galatians 5, 22, 23, the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, self-control, all those different things that we look at as being virtues of the Christian life, visible demonstrations. And then what do? We start sharing what we know. That's the next step. Remember what I said, self, congregation, the world. right? And that's what we're talking about. Self-knowledge, and then walking with the group, as the group walks, in fact, and then sharing outside of the group. This is the highest level of the individual and congregational experience here, is sharing the gospel with the unsaved. As we had in our scripture reading, Matthew 5, verse 13 through 16 there, we are light and we are salt. We ought to have an active influence. And as has been described to us recently in lessons, salt blends us in with the people, not blends us in with their actions or their behavior, but blends us in with the people so that we can connect with people, identify with them in that way as people. But light illuminates. Light sets us apart. So we have both dynamics going on at the same time. Salt means that we are actively touching people's lives as we blend with them, but light says that we have something good to offer them, and it didn't come from us, and that they can benefit from that like we do. Light illuminates. We ought not to alienate ourselves like monks in a cave or in a monastery. We need to shine, we need to reveal, we need to expose. This is our responsibility. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 22, he says, I do all things to all men so that I might save some. You can't wait for someone to conform to your preference. You need to reach out. And that doesn't mean that you need to wait till that third stage to do so. You know, like, well, later in my life, when I, you know, reach that stage, I'll finally start talking to people. It means that you need to be working toward that. Now you know where to go. Now you know where this group needs to go. So in order for all this to occur, a congregation needs to be committed to understanding that and then providing a means to get from one level to the next. And this is what we call growth. Growth is not a theory, it is a matter of practice. And the very concept of growth requires that we go beyond our present thinking and expanding. We reach forward. We're not growing just because we assemble regularly. This doesn't produce growth by itself. Even if our numbers increase, that doesn't mean we're growing the way that we should. And here's where kind of we hit the rub right here, okay? Because churches of Christ, typically in our 150, 200-year history, you know, if you go back into the early 19th century, 1830s there, where the name started and then people started identifying in this way, we tend to resist new ideas because of fear of change and loss of control. Real or imagined, by the way. And yet you look at the principles of newness and growth and transformation. These are abundant in the Gospels and the Epistles. And so it looks like we're kind of going in two different directions. Sometimes we're on one hand, we're trying to hold everything tight and conservative means to conserve, to keep things at their status quo. And so we think, well, we're conservative and that's good. And, you know, all liberals are wrong and have nothing to offer. Actually, liberal in its actual usage means generous, okay, and free. Not free from the gospel, which is where liberalism has gone, but free from the restraints of human thinking. Free from our own reservations, our own self-doubt, our own limitations, and starting to think like God's people. Remember the fruit of the Spirit? Against such things, there is no law. There's no limit to how much we can love, no limit to how much we can have joy and peace and kindness, gentleness, self-control. There's no limit to that. So who limits us? Well, we tend to limit ourselves. And I want to caution, that doesn't mean that we can accept and put into practice any new idea just because it's new and it sounds good. We still have a New Testament pattern to honor, and we have to stick with that. And I'm not saying that that hinders us or limits us. It doesn't. Doctrinally, it does define what we are to believe as God's people. But how to implement that belief and how to share that belief, we have a lot of options. We have a lot of latitude. And sometimes we fail to utilize that because we don't see the opportunity there. We cannot, or we must be, rather, a purpose-driven church. I know that phrase has been, you know, hijacked here in the religious world, but we are a purpose-driven church. We have a purpose that does drive us. We need to know what that is. We exist on purpose, I hope. We love on purpose, I hope. We serve on purpose. And if we grow, then we must grow on purpose. We ought never be to be content with the present level of thinking or loving or living, because if we are, then we're following the wrong purpose. I don't want to leave the impression here that the local church is intended to meet all your needs, because it's not. Grace is sufficient, not the church. Okay? The congregation, therefore, is a vehicle. It is not a destination. It is a tool. It is not the thing being built. God gives us lots of tools, but those tools do not become the thing being built. Okay? I have a garage full of tools, but I don't have a garage just to house my tools. The tools are there when I need them to build something or to work on something. And I want you to think of a congregation the same way. We don't have a congregation here just to house a bunch of tools, but the tools are here to build up and to edify and to work on something bigger than ourselves. Ultimately, our needs need to be met in God. All our crucial needs are met in Him. But His purpose for this group, what we call our church here, does provide essential aids and helps and a context in which helps keep us directional and focused and on track. When I think of on track, again, I think of trains. Okay? Trains on track are a good thing. Trains off track, bad thing, right? Remember down as you head south here, what was it this last year, the train derailed and went on to I-5? Bad thing, right? Okay, so we want to keep this train on track. And in order to do that, we need to know what the track is and then what the train is and where the train is going, because the track will lead us there. So we want trains not to become train wrecks, because that creates damage and casualties. But secondly, the reason trains were made is not just to have trains. The trains were made for a purpose, and those trains need to fulfill that purpose. We don't want to be a crashing train. We don't want to be a sinking ship. We don't want to be a falling plane. We don't want to be a car plowing into, a house off into a field or something like that. We want to stay on track. But that takes something from us. It doesn't happen accidentally. It doesn't happen automatically. It takes something from us. So we need to take a good hard look. If our purpose is to meet the needs of the people, then we need to take a good hard look and say, are we actually fulfilling that purpose? Are we meeting the needs of the people? Or are we just simply servicing the vehicle? Does the vehicle serve our needs? Or have we made ourselves slaves to the vehicle? And most importantly, where is Christ in all of this? Is He out there on the periphery? Or is He right in the center where He should be of everything that we're doing? As it is, I'll just be candid. And this is my opinion. You don't have to agree with it. I think we have a good group here. I think we have good families. We have good workers. We have good efforts. We have good intentions. I'll also say, and I don't mean to be negative when I say this, just a matter of my observation, we are not dynamic, but we could be. I believe that we have the potential to be a dynamic group. What we need is to get more involved, and we need leadership to involve us, and we need to know where we're going, and we need to stay focused on that, every single member. And we will be a dynamic group. And when that happens, I won't have to tell you, because you will know it. When you see it, you will know it. God causes the growth, we always say, and it's true, but not just because we assemble and exist. It's because we are committed to growth and committed to Him and committed to praying to Him for His help. And of course, there's always a person, they'll never say it out loud, but there's someone who's saying, well, I'm just comfortable with what I'm doing. And if that's you, you just missed the whole point of this entire lesson. God doesn't want you to be comfortable. He wants you to draw closer to Him. And that's going to be uncomfortable for you, for me, for us, but it's going to be extremely rewarding when we see the benefits and the fruit of that. We've got to get out of our comfort zones if indeed we want to grow. And I hope that you do want to grow. I have one more lesson to give on this little series of mine. We'll give that next week. For now, that is our lesson, and I hope that it has inspired you. I hope it has educated you, perhaps. I hope that you do something with what we have talked about. If there's anyone here that needs to respond to our traditional invitation, this would be your time to come forward if you need to, as we stand and sing the Bible.